All right, that's it. School is in session.
Thank you very much, Joey. Before I begin, I think it's really important that we remember that these podcasts are only going to be useful for some of you, and they're only providing you with a summary of everything you need to know. So it's really important that you're still reading the text, that you're still going about your normal revision procedures, doing your practice exams and all of those types of things.
Something's happened to my brain. It's all dried up.
Let's start with the brain and nervous system. What I want to start talking about is the central nervous system and the peripheral nervous system. I'm going to roughly follow the textbook here, but and I'll give you an indication of which pages I'm on, but I want you to, I guess, think of it more holistically in terms of what you know about the brain, nervous system, perception and states of consciousness at this point, or what you should know. Remember that the central nervous system consists of the brain and the spinal cord. It is central to the body. So I always imagine if you folded the body long ways, then the spine would be running straight down the middle. Obviously, if our brain sat slightly to the left or right of our skull, then we'd be somewhat overbalanced and look a tad clumsy. Remember that spinal cord is, I guess, almost like a giant freeway. Think of the Frankston Freeway, and you've got traffic going up one way and traffic coming down the other. And that's what the spinal cord is. It has sensory information coming from the outside world, going up the spinal cord to the sensory cortex. And it has information coming from the motor cortex down the body, down the spinal cord or the other side of the freeway, to the peripheral nervous system. The peripheral nervous system consists of everything outside of the central nervous system. So that's how information actually gets to the brain. The central nervous system doesn't directly connect with the outside world. It relies on the peripheral nervous system to transport that information or register that information and then transport it via the spinal cord to the brain. So if you touch something with, say, your left hand and you feel the texture of it, that's not your central nervous system that's actually registering that. It's your sensory receptor cells in your hand that is then transporting that information via your peripheral nervous system and then up the sensory side of the spinal cord to the brain, to the sensory cortex there. Let's start talking specifically about the brain and a couple of very general things. On average, it weighs about 1.5 kilos. There's a small gap between the brain and the skull, which is filled with a fluid, and the fluid provides, I guess, a cushion against if the head is knocked. The cerebral cortex is a part of the brain. It's sort of convoluted or folded outer layer covering the two cerebral hemispheres. It's only about 2 mm thick, but the cerebral cortex contains about 3/4 of the entire brain's neurons. It's involved with information processing activities such as perception, language, learning, memory, thinking, problem solving, as well as our planning and control of our voluntary bodily movements. Some areas of the cerebral cortex are dedicated to specific functions, and the areas of the cerebral cortex and their main functions can be divided into three broad categories. So we have the various sensory cortex areas, the motor cortex areas, and the association areas. Remember that the association areas are involved in integrating sensory and motor information. It's believed that the size of the cerebral cortex is linked with intellectual ability, which explains why my cerebral cortex is, of course, so very enormous. Let's talk about cerebral hemispheres. Cerebral hemispheres are the two almost symmetrical brain structures that appear to be separated by a deep groove. The hemispheres are not completely separated. They are connected at several points by strands of nerve tissue. This strand of nerve tissue, of course we all know, is called the corpus callosum. And I guess the corpus callosum is best described as being a bridge between the two hemispheres. So even though there appears to be a lengthy gap between the two hemispheres, deep down inside the brain there is actually the corpus callosum. If you have a look at page 71, it actually shows you the corpus callosum. And the corpus callosum is the bridge. It allows the left and right hemispheres to communicate with each other. The brain has four lobes, referred to as cortical lobes, and they are named after the bones in the skull nearest to them. We have the frontal lobe, which is located at the front section of our brain. I guess that makes sense. We think frontal, we think front, or at least I hope you do. The parietal lobe is located, I guess, at the top back part of your head, directly behind the frontal lobe. temporal lobes to the right-hand side and the left-hand side, just above your ears, where your temples are. That's where your temporal lobes sit. And your occipital lobes are at the back of your head, slightly just up from your neck, where you can feel those two weird little lumps of your skull. Remember that in both the left and right hemispheres, you have these lobes. Okay, so a lobe doesn't just sit in the right hemisphere or the left hemisphere, but it's actually in both of them. Okay, we'll talk a little bit more specifically about the frontal lobe now. The frontal lobe is the largest of the four lobes. It occupies the upper forward half of each cerebral hemisphere, right behind your forehead. Within the frontal lobe, the most important thing I guess we need to know about the frontal lobe is that the primary motor cortex is located at the back part of the frontal lobe. The motor cortex is involved with controlling bodily movements through its control of skeletal muscles in particular. The primary motor cortex in the left frontal lobe controls movements on the right side of your body, and likewise the primary motor cortex on the right frontal lobe controls the left side of your body. So we actually are doing opposites. So if I'm standing here now, looking rather bizarre in the room by myself, swinging my right arm, then it's actually my left frontal lobe that's enabling that to happen. More specifically, the primary motor cortex in my left frontal lobe. In the forward section of the frontal lobe are the association areas. They receive information from the other lobes and enable us to perform more complex mental functions. Remember that the association areas in each of the lobes are responsible for integrating information between the lobes. Okay, it's also the association areas in the frontal lobe that enable us to plan, estimate, decide, and consider. The frontal lobes are also involved with personality, the control of emotions, and the expression of emotional behaviour. Okay, let's move ourselves onto Broca's area. Broca's area is located in the left frontal lobe next to the motor cortex, and it's responsible for controlling the muscles of the face, tongue, jaw, and throat. Broca's area is thought to be responsible for the production of articulate speech, that is, speech that is clear and fluent. In particular, it's involved with coordinating movements of the muscles required for speech and supplying this information to the appropriate motor cortex area. Broca's area is also linked to and interacts with areas of the cerebral cortex that are involved with the meaning of words and the structure of sentences. Okay, let's talk about the parietal lobe. Parietal lobe, as I indicated earlier, is located just behind the frontal lobe. The parietal lobe in each hemisphere receives and processes sensory information from the body and the skin senses. It also sends information to other areas of the brain. Located at the front of each parietal lobe, just behind and parallel to the motor cortex, is the sensory cortex. The sensory cortex receives and processes sensory information from the skin and body, enabling us to perceive bodily sensations. The sensory cortex in the left parietal lobe receives and processes sensory information from the right side of the body and vice versa. So this is exactly like the motor cortex, which operates the opposite side of the body to the hemisphere. We do the exact same thing in terms of when we receive sensory information. The amount of cortex devoted to a particular body part corresponds to the sensitivity and amount of use of the body part. So you may remember the diagram that has homunculus with his enormous hands, and that's meant to represent the fact that the hands take up a significant amount of space on the actual sensory cortex. So our lips, our fingers and our tongue, which are very sensitive to touch and are used frequently every day, have more cortical space than those parts of our body that are less sensitive. The parietal lobe also has its own association areas, and they receive and integrate information from within the lobe and other structures and areas of the brain. Okay, occipital lobe. Now we're scooting along. The occipital lobe is located at the rearmost area of each cerebral hemisphere, and it's primarily involved with vision. It contains the primary visual cortex, or visual cortex, and that's located at the base of each occipital lobe. This is where visual information from the two eyes is received and processed. Let's talk about the temporal lobe. The temporal lobe is located at the lower central area of the brain, just above and around the top of each ear. The temporal lobe in each hemisphere is primarily involved with auditory perception, but also plays a role in memory, And our ability to identify objects and recognize faces, and in our emotional responses to sensory information and memories. It's really important that you remember that, because in an exam question you might be asked what else the temporal lobe does as well as its role in hearing. In terms of hearing, it has the primary auditory cortex in each of the lobes, and the two main features of this are sound frequency and amplitude and intensity. Verbal sounds are mainly processed in the primary auditory cortex of the left hemisphere, and non-verbal sounds are mainly processed in the primary auditory cortex of the right hemisphere. And in a few moments when I talk about hemispheric specialization, that'll make more sense. I'm going to play a little piece of music now in which you're going to realize that your right lobe is actually processing the music and your left lobe is actually processing the song lyrics. Let's talk about Wernicke's area. Wernicke's area is a specific area in the temporal lobe of the left hemisphere, next to the primary auditory cortex and connected to Broca's area. Wernicke's area is involved with the comprehension of speech, but more specifically with interpreting the sounds of human speech. It is thought that Wernicke's area is vital not just for understanding words, but also for locating appropriate words from memory to express intended meanings when we speak or write. Okay, we've talked a little bit about Broca's and Wernicke's that happen specifically in the left hemisphere, but I want to talk to you now about hemispheric specialization. The two cerebral hemispheres appear to be replicas of each other in terms of their size, shape and function. And in most cases, they interact and both perform tasks together. However, the idea that one hemisphere has specialized functions is often described as hemispheric specialization. The left hemisphere specialises in verbal and analytical functions. Verbal functions involve the use or recognition of words, such as reading, writing, speaking and understanding speech. It also involves analytical functions, such as breaking down a task into key parts or approaching a task in a sequential step-by-step manner. In terms of behaviour, the left hemisphere has exclusive functions that involve sensory information and bodily movements. If you have a look at page 86, it has a fantastic diagram there of both the left and right hemispheres, and you can see what the areas of specialty are deemed as being. The right hemisphere specialises in non-verbal functions that are not dependent on language skills. These include spatial and visual thinking, such as completing a jigsaw puzzle, reading a map or visualising the location of objects. The right hemisphere is also more involved in recognising emotions from facial cues. So a few moments ago when you listened to that music, you would have noticed that, well, you would have noticed the difference between one speaker and the other speaker if you're listening to it in a headphone set. Essentially, I guess that's meant to replicate what's actually going on in your brain. When you had just the music, then that is essentially your right hemisphere that is processing that information, because that is non-verbal and our appreciation of art and music tends to be in the right hemisphere. Whereas actually listening to and comprehending and understanding the lyrics is a left hemisphere task. So therefore, to listen to a piece of music and to a song, let's say, that involves lyric as well. That's why it obviously involves both hemispheres, because both sides are processing so that you can actually appreciate the entire product. Research on hemispheric specialisation consists of three main approaches, which are studying people with brain damage, studying people who have split brain operations, or studying people with intact or undamaged brains. When we look at people that have had damaged brains, then obvious examples are how we've determined both Broca's and Wernicke's area. The second approach of studying hemispheric specialisation being had split brains essentially involves surgically cutting the corpus callosum, which thereby disconnects one hemisphere from the other. This procedure was first used in the 40s to minimise or stop recurring seizures for people that had severe cases of epilepsy. When the corpus callosum was cut, it produced no obvious physiological side effects on patients with severe epilepsy. However, what it demonstrated was that the left and right hemisphere functions when they can no longer exchange information. So even though they couldn't communicate with each other, both sides of the brain still functioned. But it did have, obviously, other implications. I'm not going to go through those in detail, but I will remind you to read the work of Sperry, which is on page 88. Obviously, people with tact brains involve a different sort of testing, I guess. And I want to remind you on page 91 of the WADA test and also the tacheotoscope procedure, which is on page 93. Both of those you need to have an understanding of. Right, let's talk about your absolutely favourite topic of the entire chapter, and that's the brain research methods. What I'm going to do as I go through these brain research methods is just give you a brief explanation of it, talk about the positives and the negatives of it, and then move on. Specifics in terms of examples and more information you'll need to read through yourself. So it starts from about page 96. Let's talk about case studies first. Case study is an in-depth study of some behavioural phenomenon of a particular interest, whether it be individual, group, or a situation. A case study may involve a combination of observations of behaviour, diagnostic tests, interviews, and analysis of medical records. Obviously, in regards to this topic, the most interesting or noteworthy case study is that of Phineas Gage, who was the railway construction worker who got an iron rod go through his skull. This case study provided one of the earliest detailed insights into the roles of the frontal lobes in particular. The value of a case study is that the information is usually very rich and provides considerable detail that enables a comprehensive understanding of a person or their problem. However, case studies are incredibly time-consuming, and there's also problems with generalising the results from a case study. The next brain research method we're going to look at is ESB, electrical stimulation of the brain. This involves using an electrode to deliver a precisely regulated electric current to the brain, thereby stimulating a specific area of the brain. And the assumption is that if electrical stimulation of a specific area initiates a response, then that specific area of the brain controls or is involved in that response. Positives or value of the ESB is that it enables researchers to identify the locations and functions of numerous brain areas and structures, as well as hemispheric specialisation for different functions. However, one limitation of the ESB is that it can only be used with certain types of people, and it's also extremely invasive and therefore imposes risks that in today's ethical standards wouldn't be considered to be acceptable. Let's talk about the electroencephalograph, or the EEG. This is a device that detects, amplifies, and records general patterns of electrical activity of the brain. This activity is detected by small electrodes that are attached, and the EEG amplifies and translates the relatively weak electrical activity in the areas of the brain beneath the electrodes into visual patterns of brain waves. We know that the EEG is used, for example, when we look at sleep and the different stages of NREM and REM sleep. The EEG is useful for providing a general or overall information about brainwave activity, and it can be used to study brainwave activity over relatively lengthy periods of time, such as an entire evening or nighttime sleep. However, one of the limitations of the EEG is that it does not provide detailed information about which particular structures of the brain are activated and what their specific functions might be. Okay, computerized tomography, or CT scan, is a neuroimaging technique that produces a computer-enhanced image of a cross-section of the brain from x-rays taken from different angles. The research participant must first be given an injection of a substance into the vein of their arm or hand. The substance that is injected is commonly called contrast and is based on iodine. This is used to highlight the brain's blood vessels and greatly assist the radiologist and researcher in interpreting the CT images. A computer then combines the many cross-sectional images taken from the different angles around the head into a composite cross-sectional two-dimensional image. The CT scan is extremely useful for identifying the precise location and extent of damage to abnormalities in various brain structures or areas. It's been particularly useful to look at the effects of strokes, tumours, injuries and other brain disorders. CT scan has a significant limitation in that it only shows brain structure or anatomy, and it does not provide information about the activity of the brain or brain functioning. Okay, magnetic resonance imaging, or MRI, is a neuroimaging technique that uses harmless magnetic fields and radio waves to vibrate atoms in the brain's neurons to produce an image of the brain. The computer then processes the vibration and assembles assembles them into a coloured image that indicates areas of high and low brain activity. The MRI has primarily been used for diagnosing structural abnormalities of the brain. However, the MRI can be used to detect and display extremely small changes in the brain. When we look at values and limitations, the development of the MRI technology enabled even more precision in the study of the structure of the live human brain in a non-invasive, harmless way. And like the CT scan, the MRI has been invaluable for determining damage or abnormalities to particular brain areas or structures. Its main advantage over the CT is that it provides more detailed and clearer images of the brain. However, one limitation is that it cannot be used with people who have internal metallic devices, such as heart pacemakers or steel pins in their bones. However, like the CT, its main limitation for brain study is that it shows only brain structure or anatomy, and once again, not brain functioning. Let's look at the PET scan or the positron emission tomography. It produces a computer-generated image that provides information about the brain function and activity during various tasks. So the previous ones we've looked at haven't looked specifically at brain function, such as the CT or MRI scan. The PET scan does look at brain function. You're very likely to get an exam question that's going to ask you which scan is best used to determine brain functioning. And I guess this is what they want to know, if you know the difference between. PET provides images of the working brain by tracking blood flow around the brain. It is assumed that brain areas that require increased blood flow have increased neural activity. Let's talk about values and limitations. The major advantage of the PET is that it enables detailed images of the functioning of the brain, as I've previously said. Another advantage is that people without brain damage can be used in research studies, and it's significantly more sensitive than the CT or MRI. However, it does have limitations. PET requires an injection of a radioactive substance, but the radiation dosage is harmless. PET sessions must be kept short so that the person does not receive too much radiation. Consequently, there is a limit to the number of PET scans that can be taken in a session. And the lucky last is the functional magnetic resonance imaging, or fMRI. This is a neuroimaging technique that enables the identification of brain areas that are particularly active during a given task by detecting changes in oxygen levels in the blood flowing through the brain. An important advantage of the fMRI is that it can take numerous pictures of the brain in rapid succession and can therefore detect brain changes as they occur from moment to moment. Consequently, it can provide an image of brain activity averaged over seconds rather than several minutes as required by the PET scan. Being the fMRI, it has significantly less limitations because it is, I guess it's your top of the range model of your brain research methods. So unlike the PET, the fMRI technique does not require exposure to radiation. Like the PET, the fMRI enables detailed images of the brain functioning while it performs a task requiring mental processes or behavioural responses. All right, that brings us to the end of chapter two. I'm not going to go through the ethical principles. That's something you can read yourself. And I'll be back real soon.
The Force will be with you. Always.
I'll be back.